Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I nearly came to this university. I think it was an administrative error. I got offered a position in sort of design and technology or something, but when I looked at it, I hadn't done any of the prerequisite subjects. But I'd sort of fallen in love with a girl who lived just down from the uni, so I thought maybe I should go so I can be close to her. And, well, I'm glad I sort of didn't, for her sake and for mine. Now, this is quite a out of action, that's good. But then one of my mates who got expelled from a private school and joined us at the local government school in year 9, he came here and did medicine and has gone on to be quite a useful doctor, I think. I hope he is, because he's running the Dubbo Base Hospital now, so I hope he's good. So I think this question of life and death and can we know anything about it? I do like the story. I don't believe it's a true story, but it's a fun story of these three people travelling in the back of a small plane. And one of them is a bishop, Anglican bishop. One is a professor of nuclear physics from Sydney University. And the other is a student. And then they get a message from the pilot, and I'm terribly sorry, I don't have time. We're running out of fuel. There's no airports for us to land around here. I'm sorry about this. There's only three parachutes. So I'm going to take one. They're my parachutes. And you guys can work out what happens to the other two, and he jumps out of the plane. Well, immediately the professor jumps up and says, look, I'm one of the most intelligent men that's ever lived on the planet. It's crucial for the future and betterment of mankind that I not be wasted. I clearly need one of the parachutes. So he picks up a pack and out he goes. Well, the Anglican bishop, she stands up, she takes a deep breath, she looks at the young student and says, I've had a good life. I'm old. I'm sure I'm forgiven. You take the parachute. I'll stay with the plane. The student looks around and says, that won't be necessary, Bishop. You remember the world's cleverest man? He just took my bushwalking rucksack and jumped out of the plane with it. Now, you can see there's a number of things you can learn from that. One is, you can be really, really super clever in one area and make a fatal mistake in another area. And secondly, it doesn't matter how sincere your mistake is. If it's a matter of real life issues, no matter how sincere you are about what you believe, what you think you're involved in, if you are wrong, it will have some impact on your life, unpleasant, somewhere down the road. Sincerity is an overrated thing. Hypocrisy stinks. But just because someone believes something sincerely or does something sincerely doesn't mean it's therefore right. Now that's obvious. One of my relatives did brilliantly going through training as a nurse overseas. Got the governor's medal, etc. I keep up with her on Facebook, and she put out a message on the day of her first day at the hospital saying, all right, I've done nursing, can I stop now? And what had happened was she'd been involved with a few other people in giving a patient the wrong drugs and had killed the patient. That wasn't ultimately her fault, it was the doctor's fault. But she was part of it, and she just felt horrid on her very first day of nursing to be caught up in something like that. I was pleased my wife's in there. She's had our systems here are much more careful than that. But it didn't matter how sincere you are as you give the patient the medicine. If it's the wrong medicine, you kill them. And when it comes to questions of God and what's about life after death, whether it's there, what it's like, etc., who goes where, if anyone goes anywhere, it matters not. It doesn't matter at all how sincere you are, or how many of your friends or family agree with you. The question is, what's real? And at some stage, you've got to face up to the fact that life's pretty tough in the end. You make the wrong decision crossing the road, it's going to hurt. You make the wrong sort of actions when it comes to the question of life after death, and it may also hurt. But how can anyone know? Here's arguably the most important question. Because the one absolute certainty in your life that you had from the moment you were born or even before is that you will die. It's funny in our culture, we like to think we're realists and we talk boldly about certain areas, but if you start talking about death, people get very squeamish in our culture. And you're accused of being dark and unpleasant and morbid. And I reckon particularly men, in my limited experience of life, is men in Australia are more gutless than women are. And asking the question, what happens to me when I die? We think that because we crack a joke about it and hide behind a beer, we think we've coped with it. We haven't. We've just hidden. We're in denial. And it's kind of pathetic. Children will often ask adults honest, straightforward questions about death. And the parents teach them accidentally, don't ask that question. They teach you by being uncomfortable, they teach you by saying nonsense that the kid knows is nonsense, or speaking as if they know something when they don't. Ours is a funny culture that really pretends that death isn't real, and yet it's the one certainty. Some of us, you know, in this room will die without having had sex. Some of us will die without ever having owned a home. Some of us will die without ever having gone overseas. But we will all die. The statistics are reasonably good in this area. Right? One out of one. You get your fair share. You won't be singing "What About Me." You'll get it. Right? I'll tell you one thing too. I'm an old man, nearly dead. But many of you can see it quite young. Here's the trouble with being young. You die by accident, mostly. So you're just cruising along, having a great time, and you're dead. Old people like me, we tend to get warning. We slow down, we get lumps in place they shouldn't be, and we cancer, and a massive part of it, you know, and on and on it goes. The scary thing, like, a friend of mine died on the last day of high school, Jack, he drowned. Soon after that, Rod died on a motorbike. He was just driving down the meters to the hotel, and a drunk came up a one-way street the wrong way and killed him. Jamie died from heroin. And Harry died a few years later from multiple sclerosis. Now that Harry had at least some idea it was coming. But just that's how young people died. Anybody should look this question in the eye. It's younger people. My sister, I'm the youngest of five. The older of the two sisters was in a wheelchair for much of her life and after a car accident, and she knew she was dying. I'm glad she died the way she did of cancer. She's glad she died the way she did, because she knew she was dying. She could face it. She could look at questions. She had the time to look at the evidence, apart from saying goodbye to people. There's a funny old prayer in the Anglican prayer book, which almost never gets prayed now, where the congregation say, ask God to save us from dying suddenly and unprepared. Now, because we're a bunch of cowards, we want to die suddenly. If we've got to die, we want to die in our sleep. We want to die of some heart attack when we're 70 or something like that. That's ultimately, you regret that. To die suddenly and unprepared is a disaster. Well, it might be if Christianity is true. And also, frankly, if a lot of other religions are true, which we'll come to that question in a second. I was an atheist at school. I thought Christians were a joke. I enjoyed tormenting them. We had scripture in school, and I used to love beating up the old bloke. He used to not beat him up physically, but just playing mean psychological games with him. Every now and then I'd stop and look and think, why are you doing this to yourself? Why aren't you out playing lawn bowls or doing something that old people do? Why do you come in here and get eaten alive by the cruel boys at Sydney Boys High? But then soon after I became a Christian, which was when I was about 20, I finished up at Ascot Boys High teaching scripture. It was kind of one of God's jokes, you know, I'm flipping around on the other side. And you might like to think, what question do you think a bunch of sort of year 7, year 12 boys would ask most, what would be the most commonly asked question that they would ask in a Christian studies, whatever you call it, religious education course? Here's how it would go. I would make a comment like, when you die, you'll meet God face to face, you'll be judged, you'll be on trial. If you're found guilty, which you will be, you'll go to hell. If you're found okay with him, which you will be if you become a Christian, you'll be welcomed into heaven. Or something like that. Almost invariably, someone would lean back on their chair and say, how do you know? It's a good question. Or, I'm one particular bloke, very strong-looking guy, said, when you're dead, you're dead. Food for worms. That's it. Nothing. It's over. Dust. So I said to him, how do you know? How do you know that's true? He did what men do when you ask men a question that they don't have an answer for. He just got louder. I'm happy to tell you why that is not true. But you just made a very strong assertion as if you know something. Give us just a tiny bit of evidence to back up this bold claim. Because he's got none. Right? I said, stupid things about dead bodies. And I thought, of course I don't know. No one who believes in life after death thinks you can look at all, but they get the spirit. Oh, goodness gracious. So it's based on other things. But this is a very important question. How does anyone know? How can anybody know about what happens to a person after they die? I've had friends who had near-death experiences. I've had near-death experiences which weren't anywhere near death, really, but I came close to dying. But you know that sort of thing where a person dies for a minute? Kerry Packer, the most famous one, the once richest man in Australia. And famously, and my friends, my atheist friends, love to tell me the story, although it's worthless. And they say, Kerry Packer, you see, he was riding polo in that horse, that, in my horse. I think the horse should have died of a heart attack, really. Kerry had a heart attack, fell off the horse. Thankfully, one of the ambulance came, had those things that bring back anyone from the dead. I've seen it on Lost. No one dies in Lost. Someone gets up, they come. And someone had he came back. And to his credit, he then gave money so that every ambulance in Sydney could have that bit of machinery, which is good. But he rang up another famous atheist in Australia called Philip Adams, and he said, Philip, I've been dead. I've been to the other side. I'll leave out the swear words. There's no light, there's no God, there's no judgment, which means we can blankety, blankety, blank do what we like. Now, a lot of my friends have said, gee, see Kerry Packer died, he didn't see anything. That must be proof. I said, he's not even dead. You did the entrance level St. John's Ambulance course, when your heart stops, you're not dead. You're very close to death. Right? Your brain, you've got about 3 or 4 minutes before you go from biological to clinical death to biological death. You're very, very close to death. Saying, oh, I had a near-death experience. And I've met people who have had near-death experiences where they say they met God and their life has totally changed for the better. But I'm not building anything on someone whose brain's doing funny things to them. Who knows what's going on there? But saying, you know, so-and-so said they died, like Kerry Packer said he died, and he always tells the truth. So, he said he didn't see anything. And that's like someone saying, I swam out from, what's the best beach in Newcastle? That one. I grabbed the Bondi. It's like someone saying, I swam out from Bondi, I swam a couple hundred metres out there. I was further than anyone. I didn't see New Zealand. What a lot of baloney that is! New Zealand's not out there! You idiot! You swam a few hundred, you're nowhere near out there. Keep going, buddy, you'll find it. It's out there, I assure you, it's out there. So where were you going to get decent evidence? Who knows? See, the other thing, one of the guys said to me, in the same class, I've cut a lot of dudes, these guys, and the guy said to me, you know, how do you know? He then said to me, have you ever seen God? Now, I'm in a lose-lose position here, because if I say yes, I'm a lunatic. I'd like someone who says he's seen extraterrestrials, I think. If I say, yes, I'm mad, if I say no, which is what I said, he said to me, then shut up. How dare you come in here talking about something you know nothing about? He's got a good point, hasn't he? When it comes to the question of what is God like, what is out there after death, we have a massive lack of evidence. Oh, we've got lots of opinions. Most of the opinions that make us feel better. And frankly, the belief that there's no life after death makes many people feel much better. Because if you've managed to convince yourself there's nothing after death, you're not answerable to anybody, it sets you free, as Kerry Packer said, we can blankety, blankety, blank do what we like. My atheism, looking back on it, although I don't think I realised it then, was an atheism of pure convenience. I did not want there to be a God. I did not need a God. The last thing I needed was a cosmic policeman / teacher / dad wrecking my life, as all those three groups of people tried to do. And I didn't want a God. Didn't need one. Yuck. So I went from sort of ignoring, because in the end arguing that he wasn't there. But see, this one of the interesting things is that when I started to read the Bible instead of just mocking it from a distance, you discover that all the issues that we bring up have been well and truly worked through and thought through before we get there. Maybe a surprise. that the Bible has very often dealt with the very same issues that we think. Often we don't think it has, but we've never read it. Let me read you the last verse from the reading there. It says this. No one has seen God at any time. Now there's the problem, isn't it? No one. The Bible is very clear, very emphatic. It doesn't just say no one has seen God. It adds an extra word, say no one has ever, ever seen God. So no one's qualified. So here's our problem. Let me just try and do this little diagram, okay? I can barely draw a stick man, so I'll see if I can get this right. Here's us, okay? Here's me. Here's you. You're smiling because you're getting to listen to me. Okay, here's us. We live between birth and death. Or at the end of poetry, you're between the womb and the tomb. Maybe like a bit of more rhyme. Now the problem is this. At some stage or other, at various times, you'll find yourself thinking, even though you don't want to, it might happen because something happens to you or to a friend or whatever, you'll find yourself asking big questions. In spite of Australia, every now and then humans insist on being human, asking big questions. You might find yourself asking questions about God. Well, we can play with the, is there a God, but you know there is. Is there a God? What is he, she, they like? Is it an it? What is it? What is God like? What does God think? Does God notice? It's a very large universe, which the Bible knows long before you go over and put silly numbers on it. I mean, they're not silly numbers, they're great numbers, but they're meaningless. Talk about how vast the universe is. You can roll up the numbers, in a couple of years' time they'll be even bigger. When I was at school, dead set, the Milky Way was the entire universe. I watched one of those fantastic things where you move out from the Earth and now. Milky Way is nothing now. But when I was at school, the Milky Way was frighteningly big. It was enormous. But now we are, it's a piddling little nothing. And does God who made that care about you, tiny little creature that you are? What about here? What's out here? That's a question you might think of. What is out there? You may have had a friend or relative die. And even though in Australian funerals now we try real hard not to ask the one obvious question, like what? We just pretend it's just a celebration of life. It is a celebration of a life. But there's other big questions that most cultures have the guts to at least look at. You've been brought up to be stupid, so you might not. Yeah, in this area our culture will teach you to be sincerely stupid. And if you start getting wise, it'll suck you down. What is out there? See, some people think there's nothing. That's what I believe, and I've made things quite happy with that idea. Answerable to nobody. I quite like sleeping. It's like going to sleep. What's the fear from going to sleep for a few billion years? Or maybe it's reincarnation. Back here again. Start again. That's kind of fun until you take Hinduism and Buddhism seriously. If you take Hinduism and Buddhism seriously, reincarnation is no joke. Because just about everyone in Australia, we come about seriously down the life chain. No one on the planet, according to Buddhism, is going from here to Nirvana. The Buddha got here after thousands and thousands and thousands of reincarnations before he arrived. But real reincarnation in Hinduism and Buddhism is a serious business. Karma is a serious business. There is no joking with karma. And there's no forgiveness with karma. You must pay. Maybe that's it. Then you've got this thing that Christianity's got about judgment, heaven or hell. That's too frightening. But see, nobody knows. And then occasionally you might ask a question like this, well, who am I? What am I? Am I just a machine that carries my DNA and this whole nonsense that my whole life is about just painting on the DNA, in which case I may as well die. I've got three beautiful daughters. I've done my job. Get out of the way. Stop wasting the oxygen. Is that what it is? Doesn't seem that's what it is. But who are you? What are you? Are you any significance? Just a wet machine, a wet computer? What are you? And if you ask those questions, we've got really no answers. I mean, people will give you answers, but there'll be nothingness. If you dare to ask the question, who says I'm significant? Nonsense goes in our education system that everybody's a winner. What a lot of baloney, right? It's just silly. And it doesn't work in English. Kids can see through that nonsense. When everyone gets an award every game for being the best player, I just happened with one of my daughters playing netball. In the end, everybody got the most valued player. It was just in the end, the worst player in the world that the team would have been better without got the best valued most. It was just, you think the team doesn't know this is a joke? That's not how you teach someone about being. There's better reasons than that. We don't know. You see, this is what the Bible says here. No one has ever seen God. We don't know what's out there. Now, various people have come along and persuaded people. Various religions have started saying, it's this, or it's this, or it's nothing. But none of them are qualified to speak. They ask, what makes you, where's your evidence? I know you've got an opinion, you've got a couple of nice stories, it's comforting, it's worrying, it keeps people in good behaviour, bad behaviour, all that stuff, but who's got the qualifications to speak? Because no one has actually seen God. No one knows what they're going on about, but they're still going on about it. And it's worthwhile to ask the question, are you qualified? Jesus said later on in John chapter 6, not that anyone has seen the Father. John 6:46, Jesus says, not that anyone has seen the Father. That's our problem. Except, this is Jesus speaking, not that anyone has seen the Father, except, okay, there's an exception, that's good news, except the one. So according to Jesus, universal ignorance on all the things that really matter. One exception, Jesus says, except the one who has come from God. Only he has seen the Father. Now, if you get a chance to read John's Gospel, and you really should, these are the favourites, wonderful. That's Jesus' probably most common description of himself. He is the one who has come from the Father. We have come from the earth. That's a perfectly honourable place to come from. He consistently says he's come from somewhere else. He is, in a sense, an extraterrestrial. His origin is not just here. He's not just a great man who's got some interesting thoughts. He says he's the one exception. Or to go back to the verse I started with, John chapter 1, verse 18. It says, no one has ever seen God at any time. But the only begotten God, who is in the bosom of the Father, he has made him known. It's the same idea. It's that there is one exception. One genuine expert, one person qualified to speak. Now, you don't have to believe that. And you might be wise not to believe it for the moment. But at least hear what Christianity is saying. What it's saying is this, that there is a God who knows and who cares, and he sends his Son to become truly, fully, thoroughly human, born of a woman. And he lives with us. Only 30 years before they murdered him. Jesus. And he comes, and he's the guy who, having made the world, and he knows what's out here. He knows what's out there. He knows what God is like. And what Jesus does is, he talks a bit. He does other things as well, but he talks. And the intriguing thing when you start to read what Jesus says is, how much of his teaching is about himself. It's kind of weird with Jesus because he's very humble and completely centered on other people. And yet he makes the most outrageous claims that anyone in history has ever made for themselves. The Buddha, Muhammad, these guys, and this is no disrespect to any of them, never made the claims that Jesus made about himself and who he was and his relationship to God. As we're going to see later on, Jesus says, if you've seen me, you've seen God. Jesus says, if you hear my voice, you've heard the Father's voice. Jesus says that basically he was with God when they built the universe. Before Abraham was, Abraham lived 2,000 years before Jesus, physically came. Before Abraham was, I am, Jesus says. And just outrageous claims. Or just the one of my favourites is in John chapter 8, Jesus says this. Listen to this, it's extraordinary. I am the light of the world. Now, if Jesus said, I'm one of the lights of the world, we go, okay. He doesn't say that. He says, I am the light of the world. The picture Jesus is working with is that the world is in darkness about all the important areas of life. And Jesus comes and he is the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Jesus makes statements all over the place in the Sermon on the Mount and many of his great parables, bluntly in John 5, where he said, I am the judge of the living and the dead. Now anyone who knows anything about God, the God of the Old Testament, the God of the prophets, etc., knows that the only person who's the judge of you, me, Buddha, Muhammad, etc., is God. But again and again and again in parables and stories and blunt claims, Jesus says, I'm the judge. Can you see why the religious people of his day killed him? Because when people make the sort of statements Jesus makes, you either worship him as God or you kill him as a lying blasphemer. That's what happened to him. Jesus was not put to death for things he did. He was not put to death for teaching monotheism. The one group of people in the world that didn't need to be taught monotheism was the Jews. They were dying by the truckload against the Romans on that very issue. But it was about his claims to who he was. This is because he's the one who's come from God. And then he then speaks of what his father is like. He then speaks of what the purpose of your life is for, where true freedom is found. And he speaks very clearly about what's out here. And unlike what people think, I remember over the last couple of years, a number of my friends are quite strong atheists. But they always think that Christianity is comforting. It's a comforting myth they've made up for themselves that religion is all about comfort. Because I'm just strong and brave, I live without comfort in the world. Give me another drink. But Christianity is not very comforting. In many ways, Christianity makes funerals more serious. Because we realise they haven't just wafted off to somewhere nice. That we may not know exactly where each person goes, but we don't. But according to Jesus, when you die, you stand before God, you are put on trial, you are judged by his laws, not whatever laws you may think you like. You'll be judged by his laws, exactly what happens in any country, in any jurisdiction. You are judged by the laws of the owner, not the laws you make up. You'll be judged by his laws, which are crystal clear, there's no secret about them, and you'll be found either guilty or innocent. And if you're guilty of sin, if you've kept your back towards God and you've treated God as if he wasn't all that serious and it's not his world, you've lived in his, you know that the thing terra nullius, that what we did to the Aboriginals? We came in here and pretended the land belonged to nobody. What a lot of baloney that was. So we took it. Didn't belong to anybody. We didn't ask them if they thought, you know. You just took it, terra nullius. Right? And that's what humans do with God. We pretend that nobody owns the universe. I'm afraid they do. And the trouble with the owner is, when you meet this God, it's not us going to be with the guns and him with the spears. The power balance is going to be as you'd expect when God Almighty puts you on trial. This is what Jesus says. That, and you'll stand before God, and if you stand before God unforgiven, if you've kept your back to him, if you haven't given a damn what he thinks about life, and you've just gone on expecting that God will be like your second cousin in Wagga Wagga, who you just see every now and then and wave to them, or like your grandmother who just says, I just want you to be happy, darling. Right? God is not like that. God is actually, he's a little bit scary. God is a lot scary. Right? Jesus says, don't fear those who can kill the body. Jesus says, I'll tell you who to fear. Fear him who after killing the body can throw you into hell. What? Is there a man at this fine university speaking about fear of God? My goodness, I'll let anybody on this campus. Lock this down. Write this down. Put a report. How dare someone say the obvious, straightforward truth of Jesus we teach for thousands of years? Right? You're allowed to frighten people about AIDS, and you should. You're allowed to frighten people about getting drunk and driving, and you should. But to bring them a real story of real lasting danger, I can't have that. Religion's supposed to be nice and comforting. Right? Well, maybe, in your imagination. But the thing that the Bible says, it's about truth in the end. I want to move on from this, but there'll be plenty of time and questions on, hopefully. I hated it, even though I didn't believe it. I hated the fact that Christians spoke about hell. They were clearly trying to frighten me. So I stopped doing all the good things that life was about. I didn't like people trying to frighten me. I assumed that the medieval church had made it up to frighten the peasants. And then when I got a bit older, I assumed the Apostle Paul made it up. Where I come from in Sydney, anything you don't like about Christianity, you can blame the Apostle Paul for. The only interesting thing, the word hell, the word Gehenna, it only turns up in the New Testament part of the Bible about Jesus and after. About 22, 23 times a year. All but one time it's on the lips of Jesus. Now just, as a matter of fact, Jesus Christ is the hellfire preacher, if you like, in the Bible. Not the Apostle Paul. He's a pansy compared to Jesus. Not Peter, not John, although Jesus called John a son of thunder, right? Because he was so keen on the stronger parts of God's character, etc. It's Jesus. All but one reference to hell in the whole of the Bible and the whole of the New Testament is Jesus. Why? Because he knows what's true and he loves you. Look, if you knew there was 20 tons of TNT out of the floor was about to go off, and you look around, but everyone here is having the best time of their life. I can see these people having more pleasure, more excitement, more relaxation in this meeting than ever. Oh, I can't disturb them. You hate people if you don't warn of a coming danger, don't you? That's how you treat your enemy, isn't it? If you can see someone who's in danger and you hate them, you don't warn them. Even if they're a stranger, you warn them. Jesus talks about hell because he knows it's real. Real people go there. And once we get there, there is no way out that we know of. So Jesus is the one person qualified to speak. Well, the reason why I stopped believing in nothing, and then after I sort of became a bit of a believer in God for a few months, I went for reincarnation, which is the thing that Sydney people go for. The reason why I believe in heaven and hell is not because I want to. Frankly, I really don't want to believe in hell. The reason I believe in heaven and hell is because he does. And the issue for us to work out, here is the one person who makes the claim to be the light of the world, to have come from the Father. No one has ever seen God. But the one and only Son, who is at the Father's side, he has made him known. Now, this makes Jesus either the biggest liar in human history, to put himself up on that pedestal, or the greatest treasure in human history. And I'm not sure if there's a way to get out of the either or there logically. You make claims like Jesus makes, and he's either, so many people, as you know, people are dying in the last week because of Jesus. There are people in Iraq who have been slaughtered. A man who's one of my heroes, in a sense, I'm a bit weird for an old guy to have a hero, but there's this guy who has been working in Baghdad for years. He was talking the other day that a boy who was baptized and named after him was cut in half by the members of this ISIS group simply because he and his family were Christians. Cut in half. People have been crucified. People have their heads cut off and stuck on beads. I don't believe all these reports until I get them checked out. Simply because of this man. Because of their belief that he is God's son. He is the one person qualified to speak. If he ain't who he says he is, he's got a lot to answer for. But the evidence is so strong that he is. So powerful. And when you ask Jesus, as he gets asked a couple of times, for proof, in Matthew 12 and then again in John 2, both times, give us proof that you are who you say you are. They often say that after just done a series of miracles, which I would have thought would have been pretty good proof. He speaks of his death and resurrection. And I don't know anyone who's looked at the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, who's looked at the evidence, read cases for it and against it, tried to work out what happened, who's not persuaded. I know people who are not persuaded, most of my family, but they will not look at the evidence. They just assume it's false. Jesus, there's plenty of good evidence for Jesus. That's why I became a Christian. I didn't want to become a Christian, for crying out loud. But I'm glad I did. I wish I'd become a Christian earlier, but that's later. So here's what you do. This is in the end, you are asked to use your God-given brain, not just to make an income, but to work out the most important questions. Don't work it out on the level of your gut, how you feel, what makes you feel good, etc. That can be very deceptive. But look at the question of Jesus. Is there any good reason to think this man is an out-and-out liar? Why is this man so freakishly unlike any other man that ever lived? And he is. I'm happy to take over the question time. This guy might be the one, as he says he is, the light in a dark world. So you can know. And see, it's not a question of, oh, that's what the church thinks. Well, that's what you think. I don't care what I think. I don't know nothing about nothing, really. It doesn't matter what I think about life out there. It doesn't matter what I think about what God is like. I'm not qualified. It matters what he thinks. So you see how that's the issue for us to look at. That's why I'm so excited that you've got a chance into Simply Christianity, where in 5 weeks you get to read one of the eyewitnesses, or actually Luke tells you he's not my witness, which is the honesty of the man. He talks to the eyewitnesses and gets the report together. And you can find out for yourself, have an adult look at Jesus. And I think you'll find that very enjoyable. But there's, you know, there's a time when it's Philip, on the night before Jesus died, says to Jesus, if we could just see God, if we could just see the Father, we'd be satisfied. So Jesus has been a great 3 years. And all sorts of things have been fantastic. But if you can just see the Father, you remember what Jesus said to him? He said, have I been with you for so long? Do you not know who I am? If you've seen me, you have seen the Father. Now, I don't want to... No disrespect, but there is no way in a billion years that Muhammad would ever say that to Abu Bakr or someone like that, that we want to see God. Just look at me. That's a nonsense. What is Jesus thinking when he says, if you just look at me, watch me, and you're actually watching God in slow motion? And you can run it back and read that chapter again. You can see, what is God like at a funeral? What makes God angry? What makes God weep? What sort of people can be God's friends? How does God treat a person who's really horribly, terribly guilty of sin, but is willing to own it? How does God treat the self-righteous person who thinks they don't need anything? You can see what God will do with you by looking at how Jesus does it. And that other great moment when Jesus is up on the mountain praying, just a couple of times when God speaks from heaven, happens more often in Monty Python movies than it does ever in human history. But there's this moment when suddenly Moses and Elijah are talking to Jesus, and Peter's there, and I like Peter, he's talking to him. Peter, it says, Peter did not know what to say, so he said, that's my man. No idea what to say, so say something and see what comes out. And he says, great, we're here, Jesus, let's build a temple, you know, a little shrine for you, and one for Moses, one for Elijah. Cloud comes across the mountain, symbol of God's presence, and God speaks and says to Peter, this is my beloved son. Listen to him. He comes out to Peter. Peter, shut up. Stop talking about what you're going to do with your religious devotion. You're going to build a shrine for this person, a shrine for this. Let's build a shrine for them all. And God says, Peter, this is my son. The God of the universe has a son. He sends his son to the planet, and we're so busy yabbering about our opinions about God, what God should do, what God shouldn't do, and the God I believe in, as if that makes a scrap of difference to reality. And what God is saying, I sent my beloved son. At least once, shut up and listen to him. Take up and read John's Gospel, Luke's Gospel, wherever it is, and you can find out what's true about life after death. I'm going to stop there so we've got some time for questions. But just on this last statement, where Jesus says in John 18, this is the guy who's trying to decide if you kill him, execute him or not, says, for this reason I came, for this reason I was born, to bear witness to the truth. Everybody on the side of the truth, Jesus says, listens to me. Interesting test is that you can work out if you're really interested in the truth or just interested in the philosophical games, or whether or not at some stage you're going to listen to him. Crowded house, nearly very old now. a bunch of New Zealand refugees will be kindly accepted to our country. And they got this line, I won't sing it to you because that would be cruel. But the guy says, I'll tell you about myself if you're in the mood to listen. And I think that's what God's saying. I'll tell you, if, do you want to know what I'm like? I'll tell you what I'm like if you're in the mood to listen. The only movie that I like, what's that little guy who's a Scientology, that actor? Tom. The only movie thing is Halfway Came, isn't A Few Good Men. And you know that part of the great line at the end, you know, I want the truth. I think I'm right the truth. And the colonel says to him, you want the truth? You can't handle the truth. And I reckon that's the truth with many of us. The truth that Jesus brings is so exciting, so wonderful, so big, so serious, so joy-bringing. And we've got little hearts, and we find it hard. But that's what Jesus is saying. He's saying, come, listen, learn. And if you trust in him, he says, you'll have life. And you can have confidence about this. Not because you're an arrogant pig, but because you've listened to the person who knows, you've been forgiven by the one who knows and died for you, and you can head towards that unavoidable appointment with a level of joy in your step. I will now be quiet.